Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. The date is January 24th of 2022. Hopefully things are pleasant in your neck of the woods, wherever you be on your morning commute, wherever you happen to listen to awesome music podcasts like The Drop.
And yes, we are awaking on January 24th, 2022, and I have to give a massive shout out to my daughter who turned 1 year old yesterday. Thank you for coming into this world, Ingrid Joyce Brinkman. You completely changed my life and my perspective, and I will be eternally grateful for you forever. It's good right now. It's good right now. We're in that 1 year phase, Dave. She's walking, she's starting to talk. It's such a crazy time period, but you know, we're just rolling.
Ingrid is a cute kid. Those dark eyes full of wisdom and knowledge.
Somehow already she's got it all. That's crazy.
One is fun. I don't remember. Well, let's see. Certainly one for Hannah, I remember, because there's a photo of her trying to eat a gigantic donut at one, and I think that was also around the time the Mets were in the playoffs, because she would have turned one in 2015, October of 2015. I think Chase Utley had just broken the Mets' second baseman's leg, Ruben Tejada. That's how I basically like remember things, my kid's birthday, by where the Mets were at that point in time. So
it's all right. I remember Wallace as a one-year-old waking him up in his crib when the Cubs were about to win the World Series. So I completely understand the sentiment of baseball telling time. And, you know, we are here in mid-January wondering aloud if we are going to have a baseball season. Really quick pulse check. Do you feel good about the season starting on time, or there being a significant delay in the baseball season?
I haven't seen anything yet to make me suggest the season won't start on time. I wouldn't be surprised they have to maybe trim like a week or so of spring training games, and I think spring training is too long anyway, so I don't mind that too much. I'm hopeful still that the season will start on time.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat with you. I feel like there's way too much to lose, and we know the tale that the 1994 strike following into the labor, the extended labor strike into the 1995 season, lost a lot of support for baseball for close to three seasons, which is pretty significant. Into the early 2000s, you saw waning fandom for baseball. I think that both the league and the Players Association does not want to see that happen again in any way, shape, or form, especially in a world where baseball is far less popular than it was in the early 1990s to begin with. You know, I look at this argument, man, and I'm just like, I think the owners have a really good idea. And I think the players have some really reasonable demands. How can we not come to an agreement? Maybe they're just blowing off some steam right now and just telling each other to go fuck themselves so that, you know, they get a leg up before the next labor deal. But we'll see. I think if we're in the same boat by like February 10th, then we've got reason to worry. But baseball is hopefully on the horizon. Basketball is in full swing. David, how are you feeling about your New York Knickerbockers / fish playing on 420 weekend?
Ah, my Knickerbockers. It's one step forward, two steps back. Like sometimes they'll play two or three games in a row. They'll look like world beaters and they're coming together. And all the starters had these really excellent nights. And RJ Barrett's putting up 30 points and taking these like keynote threes, and the broadcaster, Mike Breen, is going, bang! But then sometimes you'll have games like last night where they look really solid and just miss a bunch of free throws and just lose in a really pathetic fashion to a not very excellent Minnesota Timberwolves team. So you watch a game like that and you think, like, well, maybe fish at Madison Square Garden April 20th is going to be a lot easier than anybody ever realized. I don't like watching the Knicks lose, but the prospect of four nights of uninterrupted fish makes me think, like, well, they can keep around 500 and just miss the playoffs. Maybe I can spin this as a positive season and I get to see fish. But yeah, last night Knicks game wasn't very good. But if I'm not mistaken, your Bulls are finally on a little bit of a downslope. Is that correct?
Yeah, we had a really tough week last week. We dropped four in a row, lost. We crushed the Detroit Pistons, and then were crushed by the Brooklyn Nets and the Golden State Warriors, both at home. I kind of expected both those games to be losses just because both of those teams are excellent, and the Bulls are, you know, kind of benefiting from a very, very hot start to the season. We lost a very tight game in Boston the following night, which I believe was a makeup game from December. I could be wrong about that, but it was, you know, we had this just very quick two games at home, Brooklyn, Warriors, game in Boston the next night, and then two days later, game in Memphis, which we lost as well. The schedule doesn't get much easier. We're playing Cleveland here in the next couple of days. We play Milwaukee, and then we get a little bit of a break with Oklahoma City, as well as I believe the Magic are coming up as well. So, you know, we may be able to start to right the ship. LaVine went down with what looked like a ACL tear in the first 3 minutes against the Warriors, which was kind of terrifying to Bulls fans. You know, as someone who doesn't have full faith and trust in Zach LaVine, I kind of was, you know, shrugging like, man, this is the concern about having this guy as one of your number one players. And then two days later, Lonzo Ball goes out, and his injury looks significant. He looks like he could miss some time. We need Alex Caruso back. But, you know, I think ultimately, to summarize this, if you look at the Bulls, where they're standing, there's a 2.5 game, 2.5 game break between the number one team, the Bulls in the East, and the number six team, the Philadelphia 76ers. I could very easily see the Bulls falling to somewhere between that 3-6 slot and it still being a successful season, because that's kind of where the Bulls are at right now. So we will continue to monitor this. We are in that really interesting part of the basketball season where we kind of know who the good teams are. We kind of know who the bad teams are. The teams in the middle have a chance still to, like your Knicks, have a chance to go on a run and change the dynamics of the season. The trade deadline's coming up, so we're starting to see some trades. You know, we're getting to that point where games start to really, really, really matter. And I'll be curious to see how the Bulls shake out. But overall, the season has been, it's been a fun season, albeit the fact that Brooklyn is the most unlucky team in the NBA, apparently. But I guess that's what you get for being a New Jersey basketball team that tries to become cool.
Well, yeah, for being a New Jersey basketball team that tries to become cool and trying to think that you're going to get a selfish prick like Kyrie Irving to agree to get vaccinated so you can play home games when Kevin Durant's on the shelf for a long period of time. But not going to do it.
Not going to do it. Not going to do it. But shifting to music, because this is, hey, Byron Whitley out there, we apologize. The first 10 minutes of this podcast have been basically all sports related. You did get a little bit of kids content there, but we are primarily a music podcast here. We just like to shoot the shit as we're getting started. Music has been slowly picking up steam here in early 2022. Dave, we got some really cool news out of our man, Stephen Malkmus, who is finally able to tour behind his incredible early 2021 release, Traditional Techniques, an album that I haven't forgotten about, but I went back and listened to after you sent me this article of his most recent performance in Portland. And I was like, oh my God, the hope, the possibilities of 2020 music based on a non-pandemic world were just so bright. I remember this album coming out and just being blown away. Tell us what happened, though, at his first show in Portland.
Yeah, Traditional Techniques was, God, if ever a really good record got completely memory-holed by COVID, like this came out at the end of January 2020, and that record was going to be like Steve Malkmus's like dad rock on the porch, smoke a joint, have a beer, embrace your dad bod album. We loved it. And then I just remember, like, once March 2020 started, it was the last thing I wanted to hear. Just because I didn't I didn't want to hear, like, laid-back, dad-rocking, fun music. So, but no, he's, he's finally playing some shows. He's got a new band he put together, I think, including Chris Funk of the Decemberist, Jack of All Trades, Matt Sweeney on guitar. And he played a set at Wilco's Sky Blue Sky, which is going on now. But before that, he played a warm-up set in Portland, Oregon, his hometown right now. And it was fascinating because in addition to playing the songs off of Traditional Techniques, he busted out Pavement's Father to a Sister of Thought off of the Wowie's Eye record with the lap steel. That kind of sounds like it could have been on Traditional Techniques. Played the Silver Jews Blue Arrangements off American Water, which is basically a Malkmus song to begin with, kind of like a duet, but his vocals are pretty prominent. And he played Wilco's Box Full of Letters. So we totally stand Steve Malkmus, just the big dad rock embrace. And I think his Sky Blue Sky set was pretty similar. I don't know if he played Box Full of Letters at that, but he also played the Jig song 1% of One, which is a big, big jam vehicle. But I hope this keeps up, because if ever was an album worth remembering, bringing back, it would be Traditional Techniques, because that was a great record.
That was a really great record, and at a time when we didn't know that the pandemic was going to become what the pandemic became, it was one of those records that felt like, oh man, by springtime, we're going to be hanging out on porches listening to this, drinking beers. It's going to be kind of the perfect soundtrack to a dad rock summer. But yeah, Wilco's Sky Blue Sky is happening, like you said, as we speak. Michael Jorgensen, the keyboardist, is unfortunately at home with COVID. I don't have the stats on this, but I'd be really curious to know when the last time there was not a sextet lineup for Wilco. I'm going to guess it was late 2004. is going to be my guess, because this band has been pretty solid throughout the last 17 years as a consistent lineup. And seeing him tweet that he was at home while the band was playing was a bit rough to see. They did bring out Mavis Staples for their previous concert as of time of recording, and they played a really good set. There were some deep cuts mixed in with some of their you know, traditional rockers that we see at typically every Wilco show. It looked to be the least Ode to Joy set I'd seen in some time. It really kind of, well, it looked like the band was really honing in on classic Wilco in a very cool way. So that is, I'm glad for our buddy Michael Gelman, who is down there right now. And that's a festival, man, that if you're listening at Sky Blue Sky and you need some live podcast commentary, the drop will come down there, and we will provide commentary throughout the entire weekend. That is kind of like that and Innings. Those are our festivals.
We will do the play-by-play. Well, oh, God, the Innings festival is so weird. It's like Incubus and like 21 Pilots and like 311 plus baseball players.
Good stuff.
It's, yeah, there's,
I'll
like,
do it.
It's, what's his name? Ryan Dempster, the pitcher, the retired pitcher. I think he has a podcast where I think he brings on baseball players to interview. He was on the Osiris podcast.
Daddy Unscripted. Yeah, because Ryan Dempster's daughter battled a number of ailments early on in life, and he came out to talk about that experience, which
right.
was really cool.
Yeah. Ryan Dempster was great on the Daddy Unscripted podcast. Really excellent Osiris podcast. But yeah, I mean, I think he has a podcast. I know the baseball player Colin McHugh has a podcast where he brings in other ball players to do some interviews. But yeah, if somebody wants to send us to Sky Blue Sky or the Innings Fest next year, we will do play-by-play. We will do play-by-play and color commentary. So by all means. One thing we noticed yesterday, I know we talked about last week, one of our favorite bands, Garcia People, has just released their new album, Dodging Dues, which is excellent. And they also just released an Aquarium Drunkard session. Of course, Aquarium Drunkard being the fantastic music blog, they do something called the Laganappy Sessions, where they get bands to come out and do covers. So Garcia Peoples recorded three covers for Aquarium Drunkard. There was a Jerry Jeff Walker cover, a Waterboys cover, and then the third one being Neil Young's Tonight's Tonight. And let me tell you, if you ever want to get mentioned on the drop, cover Neil Young's Tonight's Tonight. It's a pretty much a guarantee, and it's great.
They do a great job, and it really fits the vibe of Garcia Peoples in a way that, you know, Garcia Peoples and Chris Forsythe love covering early to mid 70s Neil Young, and that Ditch Trilogy era Neil Young just fits those bands perfectly. I know that Chris Forsythe often plays Barstool Blues, Don't Be Denied. It's just like when you take that sound from the early 70s and plant it in New York indie jam rockers, you just have a match just perfectly made right there. And I will be listening to that take of Tonight's the Night over and over and over again. Really good stuff from Garcia Peoples. Speaking of remastered classics, if you will, Christopher Hazard's YouTube page has a place that I have been living for the last couple of weeks, and I know for a fact that you have too. Tell the listeners out there who aren't aware of this, and you know, pat the listeners who are aware of this on the back for discovering this. What is the Christopher Hazard YouTube page? And why do we need to know about it?
Christopher Hazard YouTube page is basically this guy. I think he's an environmental scientist, but his hobby happens to be restoring old footage, old video footage. In this case, old video footage of the Grateful Dead, as in full concerts. So the entire page is devoted to taking old, often multicam footage of Grateful Dead shows and restoring it to often quite beautiful looking videos that look like they could have been recorded like yesterday. And 9 times out of 10, he does so. And usually he picks in terms of like syncing up the sound. He'll go to archive and he'll usually get like a pretty crisp, like Charlie Miller recording or like a Betty board or something. So really, you have all of these really good sounding, fully restored Grateful Dead concerts at your fingertips. And it's incredible the breadth and depth and how much he's put into it and the amount of work that he's put into it. I know he recently put up the formerly the Warlock shows, October 8th and October 9th, 1989, from Hampton Roads, Virginia, Hampton Coliseum, two of the greatest shows from 1989. And God, basically for the past few weeks after like Friday, Saturday night after 11:30, it's become like Christopher Hazard page time.
Yeah, I threw on October 9th, 89, one of the most famous Grateful Dead shows of all time, and also a show for me that when I was really starting to understand the Grateful Dead back in the mid-2010s, I remember someone passing me that show, and just the lore of the first Dark Star in 5 years, the formula of the Warlocks, ticket sale aspect to the overall shows, the set list in full. I was like, all right, this is as good of a place as any to really understand late era Grateful Dead. And I come back to that show often. There's a great Feel Like a Stranger to open up. There's a great Stuck Inside a Mobile, Road Jimmy, all in set one. Set two, obviously, you know, you've got that big Dark Star that comes in the middle of the second set. It's just one of those shows that, like, when you think about the Grateful Dead peaking again in, let's call it, late 1988 to summer 1992, that kind of elongated peak that they happened, but really summer 89 through spring 1990, that is like one of the greatest, purest eras of the Grateful Dead. That this show just signifies it in such a brilliant way. And I turned it on last night. My wife came out from putting our son down, and she came out to Built to Last and just sat down on the couch with me, and just like the two of us just watched it in basically silence without, you know, with like a song would come on and, oh my God, this song, and oh my God, this quality is just incredible. And it was just, it was such a pleasant experience to watch that and soak it all in.
Yeah, one other one he has up there from a similar era is December 31st of 1990, which was actually, that was broadcast on the radio. I mean, at some point, like Bob Weir even says, like, hey, out there in like Radio Land, who's listening? And friend of the podcast, Conrad Doucette, we had him back on in the Beyond the Pond days, really awesome guy. He said, this is a show that I taped off the radio and I've listened to myself 100 times and I've never actually gotten to see the footage in such high fidelity. So this is mind blowing. I guess apparently the restoration, what's required to do it, the process and the instruments is a little bit expensive. So I know Christopher Hazard has up a Patreon page. I've subscribed to it. I think anything that gives you this much pleasure is certainly worth throwing a few bucks the way of a Patreon. So certainly check that out. We can probably provide a link to it in the notes. So
absolutely. On that note, what have you been watching on TV? What have you been reading elsewhere that has been bringing you intellectual pleasure, or just entertainment value in general?
Books and TV. I just finished the book called Hollywood's Eve Babbitt's and the Secret History of Los Angeles. I got this book because Eve Babbitt's, she recently died. She was 78 years old, and she was sort of, God, how to describe her? If she was, she kind of lived Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s. She was kind of like somebody whose celebrity Los Angeles really passed through. I guess she was a chronicler. She was a bit of a groupie. She had a lot of famous friends, a lot of people who were on the up and up at the time, friends and paramours like Jim Morrison, Steve Martin. God, the list can go on and on. And eventually, kind of the 1970s, she decided to chronicle this, and she became a writer, and her books are kind of like fictionalized, albeit highly nonfiction versions of what she experienced in Los Angeles throughout the 60s and 70s. And I first came to know her because a book I had bought my freshman year of college, it was an anthology called Drinking, Smoking, and Screwing. It was an anthology about the art of pleasure, and she had an essay in it, and I was always fascinated by this one essay. I had kind of forgotten about her, but with her recent death, I went and took some books out of hers, the library, and there was a biography of her from 2019, which was this book, Eve's Hollywood, which was very well done and kind of written, and almost like it almost felt like reading one of, Eve's Hollywood is the Eve Babbitt's book. Hollywood's Eve is the biography from 2019. And it kind of felt like reading one of her books. Fascinating character. Well done book. Highly recommend checking that book out. In terms of television, just finished Yellow Jackets on Showtime. Fun show. It's got some horror.
I need to watch that.
It's got some loss. It's got some existential dread. And it's got lots of 1990s needle drops, because it goes back and forth between 1996 and the present day, kind of about this high school girls soccer team that was in a bad plane crash in the wildness of Ontario, Canada, I think, and how they survived, and then going back to the survivors in the present day. And all the survivors in the present day are my age, because I was the same age that the girls were when the plane crashed. So it's all these great 90s rock songs. It's fun show, often a little terrifying, that's your thing, but worth it.
I've heard really good things about that show. I feel like I need to watch it as well. I am currently reading two books because I can never just read one book. I have to have options at the end of the day when I get in bed. I'm currently reading Rick Perlstein's Nixonland, which is Rick Perlstein is a historian. He has an overview of conservatism in America. He has four books out currently. The first is about Barry Goldwater. The second, Nixonland, is about the rise of Richard Nixon. The third, I think, is called The Invisible Bridge. It's about the period following Watergate and 1976. And then the final book that has come out thus far is called Reaganland, and it focuses on 76 to 80. Jimmy Carter wins the presidential election in 1976. Ronald Reagan loses the primary to Gerald Ford that year. Ronald Reagan's rise through the late 1970s as he goes on to run for president in 1980 and really changed the dynamics of American politics that we are still feeling to this day, and really changed kind of the tone and tenor of the country to a very conservative bent over the last 40 years. It's a topic I'm just eternally fascinated by. I grew up in a very conservative home, have since become quite liberalized to the point that I would categorize most of my political views as extreme left, but I tend to find that the anger that I feel inside of me towards the conservative viewpoint in the world is better served by understanding it and by learning more about it. So I've been reading Nixonland and trying to it's been fascinating. It's been a fascinating read. It really gives you a perspective deep, deep, deep into how long what we're dealing with right now. And that is the kind of Trumpist political approach. That is the move on the right to limit voting rights, to try to turn back the clock towards the 1950s, if you will. How long that's been going on, and that this is kind of an eternal battle. This is nothing new. And for us here in more progressive democratic America, blue America, if you will, to take back power, we would be wont to learn the lessons of the past, because the strategic options to overcome this are all there. We just need to learn about it. So it's been fascinating to read that. I've also been reading a book. I just bought this in my recent trip to Montana, called The Overstory by a man named Richard Powers. And it's actually connected to one of the things I was watching on TV. So I'll talk about both of them, which was Fantastic Fungi, which is a documentary on Netflix. Both of these, The Overstory and Fantastic Fungi, the main character is nature. In the overstory, the main character are trees. In Fantastic Fungi, it is all about mushrooms. And both books, the book and the documentary, in explicit detail, break down how much is happening below the surface and how much interconnected knowledge and insight and emotion and nutrients are happening below the surface. In Fantastic Fungi, you learn that when you go hiking in the woods, every step you take, you are stepping on 300 miles of a fungi network below your feet. And that network keeps trees connected, it keeps nature connected, and it sends information and help and nutrients and so on and so forth between trees through a fungi network. And reading the overstory, which the beginning of the book is all set around a chestnut tree in rural Iowa, following a plague of chestnuts in the eastern part of the United States that wiped out like 99% of chestnut trees to that point. It's really reshaping my perspective in a way that I did not think was possible at this point in my life. And reading this, consuming this, while also consuming history about conservative America is just like making me want to disappear to a cabin in the woods and, you know, just kind of live my own life and live amongst nature. I don't know. It's been really rewarding and really fascinating. I also watched, the last thing I'll say, highly recommend this to all of our listeners, Taylor Swift's Miss Americana documentary on Netflix. It documents Taylor Swift's post-reputation creative process for the album Lover that came out in 2019. It documents her rise, her desire to constantly be perceived as good, her desire to constantly make people happy, and then this shift she went through in the late 2000s, early 2010s, where she realized that that was never going to be possible. She releases Reputation. She does not get nominated for Best Album of the Year by the Grammys. And she just dives into her work and records this album, Lover, which was kind of a return to form in some cases, but also had some really fascinating creative moments in it prior to her excellent work in 2020 with Aaron Dessner and Justin Vernon. It was just a really great dive into her creative process and her as a person. And it was a really well-made documentary. I highly recommend anyone watching it. Gives you kind of a unique perspective on pop music, but pop music from the sense of artistry. And I really enjoyed it and have been listening to a lot of Taylor Swift as a result of it.
So, as of you know, we are a part of the Great Osiris Podcast Network. So just wanted to give a recommendation for some recent ones that we've been listening to or maybe upcoming. I just listened to an episode of the podcast Wheels Off with Rhett Miller, of course, the front man for the long-running band, the Old 97s. This was actually a podcast that came out, I think, in the middle of 2021. It was his interview with Jeff Tweedy, where Jeff Tweedy had just released his book, How to Write a Song. I think that's what it's called, How to Write One Song. And they kind of go into detail about the songwriting process. Anytime someone kind of as chipper and laid back as Rhett Miller interviews someone similarly laid back dad as Jeff Tweedy, you're going to get some really fun chestnuts. And that's what it was about. It was a pretty easy 45-minute conversation that I greatly enjoyed. And I enjoy most of Rhett Miller's conversations. Anyone who's been in the music industry, has been playing music, has been touring for that long, is obviously going to have a good rapport with people and good things to say. And he does. So, yeah, I would highly recommend the Rhett Miller Wheels Off with Jeff Tweedy.
I need to listen to that. That is that would be a fantastic interview. Rhett does such a great job, and Tweedy is, as you all know, one of our favorites. I want to tell you about a podcast that will be debuting this week as of this podcast being released, The Great Beyond. Is it a Goose podcast or is it not? Well, we'll find out. The Great Beyond is hosted by Greg, Bruce, and Joey, three awesome dudes. All have kind of ties to the larger music industry and all are huge Goose fans. The Great Beyond's been going on since mid-2021, recapping Goose shows, Goose runs, and we brought them over to Osiris Media. It made sense. We wanted to start more constructive Goose content, similar to how we focus on Grateful Dead and Fish content on a week-to-week basis, as those tours are happening and looking at the band from a historical standpoint. And I've been working pretty closely with these guys, getting the show off the ground. They have a lot happening here in the winter and spring of 2022. Goose will be doing a pretty extensive winter tour coming up here in the next couple of weeks, actually starting on January 26th. So Goose will be touring the show. Will be recapping each show live the morning after, and then we'll be doing weekly podcast releases covering everything from Goose's history and kind of what the last few years have been like for the band, specifically focusing on kind of that post-2019 Peach Fest concert when the band really became well known by the larger musical public and jam band aficionados. We'll be talking to band members, we'll be talking to people that have influenced the band, we'll be talking to fans. There's just going to be a ton of conversation, a ton happening on the podcast. It's going to be really fantastic. I'm really excited to see them start rolling and to get people, you know, give people that kind of day-to-day and week-to-week insight into Goose that I think is definitely needed. There's a lot happening under the surface with that band that's really fascinating. They're in a really interesting period in their own overall history. So what better than a podcast to complement it?
So you're saying that they seem really placid, but then going under the water, they're paddling like crazy?
They're paddling. Yes, this is it. Yes, they're coasting above the surface, going crazy below. You're absolutely right.
Just like a goose. All right.
Just like a goose. With that, let's get to the big topic of the week. So, we were trying to figure out what to dive into this week, and we kept coming back to, like, we're both reading a ton, and we both have read some rock biographies over the last couple of months, and it's a practice that we like to take part in on an annual basis and kind of regularly throughout our lives. And we figured this would be a good time to kind of empty the vaults of some of our favorite books that rock. We figure that you all are probably in need of some reading material here in early 2022. So many unknowns on the horizon. We wanted to give you six book recommendations. So we're each going to have three recommendations here that we share of books that rock that we love. David, what is your first book that rocks?
From a book that rocks. So I'll say of the three books that I have picked, all of them are available at the New York City Public Library system. I made sure of that. But the first one I actually own, just because I go back to it so goddamn much. This is Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, written by, I should say compiled by Legs McNeil and Jillian McCain. Legs McNeil, oddly, being from my hometown of Cheshire, Connecticut. So, This is indeed an oral history. Everything is done in chunks of interviews, and it basically talks all about goodness, punk in New York City. It goes back and forth between New York City and Los Angeles and England. It covers things like the Sex Pistols. It covers the Stooges. It covers the Dead Boys in Cleveland. And basically, it's all about CBGB. Everything that you could want to know about the rise of punk rock throughout the 1960s, throughout the 70s, and early, I think, touching on somewhat of the early 1980s is covered in this book. And it's just the levels of abuse and ridiculousness and things that go on the entire time. You're just saying, what? What? Holy shit. No fucking way. Did that actually happen? Like, there was a time in the late 70s in New York City when, like, everyone realized that the punk rockers down at CBGB were, like, the new cool thing. That even, like, the Rolling Stones wanted to hang out with them. So you get these stories in this book about, like, Keith Richards hanging out with, like, Richard Lloyd from television and doing all kinds of drugs. And you keep asking yourself, how is this person still alive? How is Iggy Pop still alive? Iggy Pop gets his ass beat by rednecks, like, every four pages of this book. And you're like, how is he still alive and kicking today in his mid-70s looking fit and sexier than ever and still putting out records? That shouldn't be possible. What makes him different? I mean, to me, a quality of an excellent rock and roll book is something you can just, like, take you to the bathroom and sit down to John and go anywhere in the book and read, like, 15 pages, do your business, get back up, and, like, be smarter for it. And so that's definitely one of the best books in that regard. And once you read this book, you'll go back and listen to punk records. You'll go back and want to see, like, other biographies on the people that are in this book. It's just kind of one of those books that you can just weave an entire web and, like, grow a tree, I guess you could say, out of it. So, highly recommend if you haven't read it already. Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk.
That's a great rec. All right, so my first one is perfect with the times right now. Get Back came out right over Thanksgiving and had me diving into the world of the Beatles all over again. As I noted previously, I was just on a trip with some buddies in Missoula, Montana. Let It Be went on at one point, and it just, like, you know, everyone's throwing out their favorite scenes from the documentary. Everyone's talking through their favorite songs, how much they're listening to, what eras of the Beatles they're listening to. And I'm finding myself in a prolonged Beatles period for, like, the fourth or fifth time in my life. You know, the Beatles are one of those bands. They're everywhere. They're you can't escape them. I don't care what music you listen to. I don't care if you've ever done a Beatles deep dive yourself. You cannot escape them. They are literally everywhere. And so I wanted to find a book that summarizes this feeling, because right now my sensation of listening to the Beatles is all-encompassing. And there's nothing better than Bob Spitz's The Beatles, which came out in 2005, which is a near 900-page overview of the entire history, career, life, legacy of the Beatles. You start with John, Paul, George, and Ringo as babies. Get a sense of their upbringing in 1940s and early 1950s. Liverpool, you get the relationships as the band first forms. You get their first gigs. You get them in Hamburg. You get them coming to America. You get them taking LSD. You get them starting to split apart and splinter. And then you get them ultimately breaking up and where they went immediately afterwards and where we're at at that point, 35 years after the conclusion of the Beatles, you know, this picture of what did this band mean to us. And it's just really well written. Bob Spitz gets great interviews. He gets great archival insights. And it's just kind of one of those books that if you need more Beatles in your life, and if you want kind of this authoritative overview, almost as if you're, like, looking at, all right, what is the French Revolution book? This is that, but for the Beatles. This will give you the full breakdown of the band, full insights into them. You'll walk away kind of, like, to Dave's point. I love how you described what a good rock bio or rock overview, historical overview should be. You read about 15 pages and you're like, you know what? I'm going to go and put on the deluxe version of Rubber Soul because I want to hear the non-album tracks that were recorded. And I want to get a real sense of, you know, where the band was at through the process of this. You walk away a little bit smarter, you walk away with some better insights, and you walk away thinking to yourself, okay, I understand the Beatles a little bit better than I did before. And that's kind of what it is. What do you got next, Dave?
My next book is called Black Postcards, and it is the memoir of Dean Warham, who, of course, being the frontman of the bands Galaxy 500 and Luna. And Luna had broken up for a while, but they play shows on and off nowadays in New York City and Los Angeles, I think. So, certainly, if you want to learn about how Galaxy 500 songs come together, if you want to learn about Luna, this book will do that. But what's interesting is that kind of mostly what this book does best is that it offers a really fascinating overview of that time in the early to mid-1990s when the alternative radio, alternative MTV boom, when major labels were just snatching up bands left and right, when a band like Shudder to Think could be on a major label, when a band like The Boredoms could be on a major label. He talks about Luna was on the label Elektra, also Fish's label at the time, and he talks about how bands would just get signed before they'd even played a show, just based upon two songs and how they looked and how that could really impact quite badly. He talks about this band called Vaganza that I've never heard. I just remember James Iha from Smashing Pumpkins saying how good they were in Rolling Stone. And I think they just got signed, never having played a show, and immediately fell apart. So it gives a good overview of that era. But also, Dean Warham has a very dry sense of humor. If you've heard a Luna song, you would understand that. Very dry, somewhat wry, and he doesn't always come off as the best guy in this book. There's certainly some things that he does to his family, to his wife at the time, which can be seen as not so awesome, and he acknowledges that as such, kind of the perils of being a rock musician out on the road, so to speak. But there's also some very funny incidents on the part in the book where he talks about the recording of Luna's 1997 album, Pup Tent. It's just 30 pages of some of one of the most amusing behind the scenes, making the record, what goes on, band members interacting, how band members grow to hate each other, how you grow to hate your producer. Just very amusing, very sarcastic way of going about things. It's just the book I keep going back to over and over. I mean, obviously, I'm a very big fan of Luna. I'm a big fan of Galaxy 500. And kind of this book even made my Luna obsession deeper. And just kind of thinking about some of the stuff he indulges in on the road, you ask yourself, Luna's not a particularly rocking rock and roll band. They're pretty sedate and kind of more on the mid-90s alternative sedate, almost like shoegaze tip. And yet him and the band still find ways to get into trouble that are quite fascinating. So I guess for an overview of the 1990s, an overview of life on the road and trying to maintain the rock and roll balance between the road and your family at home, I would highly recommend Black Postcards by Dean Warham.
That sounds awesome. So my favorite era of my favorite artist, Mr. Bob Dylan, is the period between 1967 and let's call it 1973. I love the way that he completely disappeared into the world of his own. He collaborated with a bunch of artists who also wanted to disappear from the mainstream zeitgeist that had gotten too noisy, too pop-centric, too drug-riddled, and he wanted to find some semblance of peace, domesticity, and kind of acceptance in himself in the Hudson Valley region of New York. No better place is this described and laid out to us than in the old Weird America by Greil Marcus. This book focuses on the world of Dylan's basement tapes, which he recorded with the band in the late 1960s, was ultimately released in the early 1970s, and then released again here in, I believe it was 2014, when they put out the full basement tapes on a massive vinyl box set, which I own and is one of my favorite things to listen to. This book, huge shout out to friend of the pod, John Prue, who is, I believe, a bookseller, bookshop owner in Birmingham, Alabama.
No, he manages a Barnes & Noble in Edison, New Jersey.
I didn't know that. I thought he lived in Alabama.
No, he definitely lives in Jersey.
Oh, shit. John Prue.
Yeah.
John Prue, you've been to the,
great
you've
guy.
Been to there? You just know this.
I think
you know
I
this
went
better
there
than
in
me.
College.
All right. All right.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Huge shout out to friend of the pod, John Prue, who manages a Barnes & Noble in Edison, New Jersey. Go visit it. He hosts, along with Justin Bruce, a fantastic podcast called Deeper Listening. He sent me this book when my daughter had just been born and said this was one of my favorite books when I, too, had a daughter that had just been born. Really sweet, thoughtful gift, and I read this last spring. Coming off of a year where I did a full Dylan discographical deep dive, this was such a great way to focus on a singular era in Bob Dylan's history and my favorite era of him. You get, you know, real insight into kind of initially what attracted him to this region, what attracts artists in general to kind of retreat from the world and into their own minds. And, you know, for Dylan, this was a way for him to take this fascination he'd had with the American songbook and with American music history and really apply it down to the roots. You're really focused on like mid-19th century rural songwriting within this period in his history, be it covers that he did of traditional songs or be it songs that he was writing on his own. He tapped into something that was incredibly simple, incredibly of the earth, incredibly of American history 100 years prior. And so I cannot recommend this enough. It is for anyone who listens to Dylan, for anyone who listens to the band, for anyone who at some point in time has found themselves in a cabin saying, you know, I could live here. Even if you can't, you know, we've all been in that moment where like the world is shut off. It's kind of silent elsewhere. I could live here and I could really make it happen. This book is for you. It's a great insight into what happens when you apply that and music comes out of it. So, The Old Weird America by Greil Marcus. What is your last book that rocks, Dave?
The last book I'm going to talk about, I believe, was released in 2011. This is called See a Little Light, The Trail of Rage and Melody. It is written by and is the memoir of one of my heroes, Bob Mould. Of course, Bob Mould being the front man behind Husker Du and Sugar and a very prolific solo career. So the book does give a really good soup to nuts synopsis of his time at McAllister College, how he ended up starting Husker Du, how Husker Du eventually gave way to Sugar, and then also talking about how that gave way to his solo career. So in terms of a career overview, it definitely gets that done. But really, I think kind of the beating heart of the book is really him sort of discussing what it's like to be a largely closeted gay man throughout the 1980s, his eventual coming out, and then kind of sort of getting to enjoy a second life as an openly gay man, and kind of, I guess, doing things like visiting like Fire Island with his boyfriend, and certainly doing a big DJ thing in Washington, D.C. at the time called Blow Off, I believe. Just really, it's a very warm story. It's he's an excellent writer, which you can imagine based upon the thousands and hundreds of great songs he's written over the years. And it really just like an interesting evolution of like a man, interesting evolution of society. And just the whole time I'm reading it, I just got, you know, a real feeling of warmth, a feeling of like understanding of what he had to go through all these years. And he always talks about kind of, he got to almost live like a second life. I know he got to live in New York's Greenwich Village for a long time with his boyfriend at the time. I know he recently lived in Germany. I think now he lives out in San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken. Still touring like crazy, still putting out fantastic records, still really having the big melodic punk shoegaze sound that he made his name on and that I've loved. And just kind of like reading the book kind of assured for me that, you know, he really does seem to be a good guy, I guess you could say. He seems to be like a really, really menschy individual who has his head on straight. Throughout the Husker Du years, he definitely was not sober, but I'm pretty sure that he's sober now, and he really goes into much detail about his struggles with alcoholism in the book. Just if you have any interest about the man, any interest about his career, kind of any interest about, you know, what it means to keep things bottled up inside for a long time, would highly recommend you check that book out. I got it out of the library, just luxuriated it in the summer of 2021 in the middle of the pandemic. So, See a Little Light, Trail of Rage and Melody by Bob Mould.
All right, for my last book, I'm going to talk about one that came... I'm going to talk about one that came out in 2021. It is called A Little Devil in America. It is by Hanif Abdurraqib, who is a fantastic music journalist, fantastic writer, hosts an incredible podcast called Object of Sound, which does something that I'm incredibly envious of. It gets information and knowledge and insight into creativity and music in under 30 minutes. It is an amazing podcast to listen to because the timing of it is so non-committal, but you get so much in there. And A Little Devil in America gives you a lot of the same in a pretty compact, just around 300-page book. This book focuses on Black performance throughout American history and the nature of Black performance in a country that has had so many challenges with racism over its entire history for a variety of reasons that we don't need to go into here. But the book focuses on how Black people have entertained whites, entertained each other, led the cultural pushes forward in music, be it in blues, R&B, jazz, soul, funk, disco, hip-hop, you name it. Essentially, everything that we have listened to musically throughout our entire history as Americans, some way, shape, or form, came from or started through Black communities and Black suffering. And it's a really, really important book for right now. There's a lot happening culturally in our world that this topic is incredibly present. But it's also just a really great reminder of take out the race element in all of this. If you're going to listen to music, if you're going to spend time trying to understand music, no matter what, it is always important to dive back into the history of the music that you're listening to. It's important to understand where this music comes from and where this music has found success and where this music has found challenge and where this music has found an ability to connect with people in a way that may be different from the way that it connects with people today. And for me, reading this book, it has given me a ton of insight into, you love a band, you have a lot that you want to understand about a band, about music. Try to understand what happened before them. Try to understand where they came from, because you're going to find a completely new world that is beyond your initial comprehension as of time of discovery of the music that you love. So, The other thing I'll just say is, you know, I think that we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to musicians that came before us to actually understand and acknowledge their importance and their impact on the evolution of music. And this book does it in pretty stark and quite colorful language, in a way that makes you feel like you're reading something modern, even though you're following the trajectory of Black performance over the last 200 years. So, A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib. Excellent, excellent music writer, and great book.
That book sounds amazing, and using my phone and an app, I just was able to put a hold on it at the New York Public Library. And there are 30 holds on it in front of me, meaning I'll probably get to read it in 2024. Better late than never.
It's a good book. Well, this was fun, man. We should do this once, like every couple of months. This was fun to kind of clear out the bookshelf, and gave me a couple of books to put on my list as well. So as we do here at the drop, we are moving backwards in time every 5 years. I think starting next week, we're going to start going through new album recommendations coming towards the end of January here. I know that we both have been starting to text about records that we've been digging. Do you have a favorite record of 2022 thus far? Just really quick. We don't have to recommend anything, but do you have a favorite record of the year thus far?
Yeah. Obviously. Dodge and Deuce by Garcia Peoples.
It's a great record. I think I would put the Weeknd, Don FM, as my favorite.
Oh, that's good.
It's been the record that's captured me the most in early 2022.
That is a good album. That's I like that record. You get, what's his name, does a lot of work in that record. Owner Tricks Point Never, right?
Owen Tricks Point Never, one of my favorite producers in modern music. So we'll do some album recommendations starting here next week, but we are moving five years back in time. We've done 2017, we did 2012, we are now to 2007, 15 years ago. Before we get into the recommendations, just really quick, Dave, where were you at in 2007?
2007, I was living with my then girlfriend, soon to become engaged wife. I got engaged at the end of 2007. 2007 was like kind of peak blog rock era, I want to say.
Yeah.
There was like a lot of, I was writing for the online webzine Coke Machine Glow and getting tons of crappy CDs in the mail. This is before you had started getting like links from publicists. They would still send you physical material. So normally when you see like a padded mailer in your mailbox, you get excited. I'd be like, oh, all right, here's more CDs from some indie band that wants me to write about them, and they might not be very good. yeah, but one record that was incredibly good in 2007, still is Spoon, Ga 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 Ga. I think Ga 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 Ga, because the second song on that album, The Ghost of You Lingers, has that keyboard sound. What's funny is I first heard this record, I saw an Arcade Fire concert in 2007, which was ostensibly something that people actually wanted to do back in 2007. sat two rows behind Zach Braff, whose career is actually kind of mirrored that of the Arcade Fire. It's another podcast for another day. And the National opened up that show. So in between the National and the Arcade Fire, I heard over the PA it sounded like Spoon, but it wasn't any Spoon songs I was familiar with. I'm like, is Spoon of like a new record coming out? Because I know Spoon or Arcade Fire, they're both on Merge. So if anyone has the right to play an unreleased Spoon record, it would be their label. And sure enough, I'm like, these songs sound great. Sure enough, that was at that time the unreleased Spoon album being played before the Arcade Fire. So I think when people talk about, everyone talks about Spoon as being like consistent to a fault. Every record is good. When some people talk about the album that is most good, you know, like an Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Probably the best Spoon record often gets talked of as being Gaga Gaga. I think it's the best Spoon record. It's my favorite. 35 minutes, no filler whatsoever, kind of almost reads like a book with like an introduction, a middle, and an end. That's to me is just their most flawless album. And my favorite song is the fourth song called Don't You Ever, which is kind of a cover from a band called The Natural History, but it's a cover, but they kind of put their own spin on it in a way. But it's a song that's on my all-time most favorite song Spotify mix, definitely the song I listen to the most on the record. I know that they still play it in concert to this day. So that's the song we're going to listen to. But I know Spoon has a new album coming out this February and called Lucifer on the Sofa. The two songs they put out from that album are both awesome and suggest it could be a really good Spoon record. But this Gaga Gaga legendary album makes you think of 2007 right off the bat. Let's hear a little bit of Don't You Ever.
So I'm going to say something slightly bold, and I'm curious your reaction. I was 22 years old in 2007. I lived in the greatest apartment I will ever live in my entire life. I actually went to it this past weekend when I was in Montana. Out of bay windows on the second floor, I could see three mountain peaks out of different windows. I was right around the corner from my favorite brewery in the entire world, the Kettle House Brewery. I was right across the street from a great little bakery. I was right across another street from a fantastic little pizza place where I could get a slice of pizza in the afternoon. I was right around the corner from my favorite breakfast spot. I was right over the river from downtown Missoula. I was steps from a river trail where I could go for runs and I could go for bike rides around Mount Sentinel. And I was, you know, a 5-minute bike ride from campus. It was perfect, man. It was the greatest place I've ever lived, ever. No place, no house, no matter how big or nice it is, will ever top that apartment. A lot of the records that I listened to in 2007. The other thing I would say is that fall, I went to Europe for the first time, and I spent the entire fall of 2007 in Europe. So my end of 2007 was living abroad and traveling and really getting this first exposure to the world outside of what I had known. All these records from 2007 really, really resonated with me at that period of my life. I think 2007 might be the best year of music I've ever experienced.
It's up there. It's really good.
I want to just read for you the top 20 albums on Pitchfork's top albums of 2007, because it's insane. All right, I'm just going to go through this quickly. 20, Liars, self-titled. 19, Feist, The Reminder. 18, Kanye West, Graduation. 17, The National, Boxer. 16, Lil Wayne, The Drought 3. 15, Justice, the cross record, the only Justice album that anyone needs to know. 14, Deer Hunter, Cryptograms. 13, Jay-Z, American Gangster. 12, No Age, Weirdo Rippers. 11, Jens Lehmann, The Night Falls Over Cortadala. I don't know if there's any artist that feels more 2007, 2008 than Jens Lehmann. 10, here's where we really, really, really get into it. But like amazing records in the 11 through 20 slot. 10, Burial, Untrue. 9, The Field, From Here We Go, Sublime. 8, Battles, Mirrored. 7, Spoon, Ga 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 Ga.
Too low.
6, it probably is. I think you're right. 6, Animal Collective, Strawberry Jam. 5, Of Montreal, Hissing Fauna, Are You the Destroyer? Another very 2007 band. 4, extremely. 4, Radiohead, In Rainbows. 3, MIA, Kala. 2, LCD Sound System, Sound of Silver. And number 1, the album that I am going to be talking about, Panda Bear, Person, Pitch.
Wow, all it's that and fucking, In Rainbows, like, man.
It's, I know, when you see In Rainbows at 4, you're like, oh my God, yeah, that came out in October 2007. That was like the first pay what you will record. Panda Bear, Person, Pitch was a record that came to me by chance. I was not familiar with Animal Collective. I would become familiar with Feels and Sung Tongs after 2007. But a friend of mine, while I was traveling overseas, handed me Person, Pitch, and I threw it on. And you know, there's nothing to indicate what you're about to expect or what you're about to get from the album cover, which is kind of a collage. Like within a hot tub of a variety of characters, plus circus animals, plus there's a panda bear in there. The album starts with this rising hypnotic chorus of sorts to Comfy and Nautica, which is the song that we're going to play. This album completely rescrambled my brain. This is one of those albums that changed the way I hear music, changed the way I would forever hear music. Samples galore, but in a very organic way. The acoustic guitar features prominently here. There are loops, there's drones, there's Noah Lennox's just like gorgeous tenor that just like floats within and above all the music. It is something to behold. It is a record that completely reshaped the way I hear music. And it is a record that will forever put me in 2007 at a time that was filled with impressionability, filled with discovery, filled with new ideas, new possibilities. I mean, I was fucking 22. You're like old enough to have read some really important books and listened to some really important albums, but you're still young enough that there's a lot to come and there's a lot of life ahead of you. So you feel like you know a lot, but you haven't really experienced a ton. It's a really interesting place in life. And for me, this year was huge for me. As I said before, I lived in one of my favorite places I've ever lived, probably the best place I'll ever live. I traveled a ton and I found myself in a place in life that was very, very, very conducive to what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And it opened my eyes up to a lot of possibilities of alternative paths in life. And this record was one of those records that complemented that. So we're going to listen to a bit of Comfy in Nautica off of Panda Bear's Person, Pitch. All right. Thank you all for hanging with us here today on January 24th. We went through NBA. We talked Steve Malkovich. We talked Sky Blue Sky. We talked our books and TV that are on tap right now. Talked new Garcia Peoples. Talked The Great Beyond. Talked Rhett Miller and ran through some of our favorite rock books, as well as taking a brief diversion in the world of 2007. We'll be back next week with more drop content for you, plus our final stop in the aughts with a dip into the world of 2002 music. I can't wait to get to there. There's some really good. 2002 was a really cool year, and spoiler, my favorite record of all time came out in 2002, so we'll see if we talk about that.
2002, post-9/11 trauma music. But you're right, there's a lot of really good stuff in 2002, especially New York City, East Village stuff, where I was making my home at the time. So, if you've gotten this far, as always, we say thank you very much for hanging with us. I know this is always the highlight, one of the highlights of my week, getting to record this and chatting with Brian Brinken for an hour and change. So, come back next week. We'll have something fun and interesting for you. We will hold hands. We'll say kumbaya. And we will indulge in the drop.
Osiris. Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA Podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.